I'd like to welcome you tonight to the 2007 Sunstone Symposium Friday night plenary session. My name is Rory Swenson. I'm a member of the Board of Directors for the Sunstone Education Foundation. And I'm honored to be chairing this session of Pillars of My Faith. Prior to beginning this session, I'd like to mention and call your attention to news from this morning. You may have already heard, maybe not, but early this morning, President James E. Faust, second counselor in the first presidency, passed away. If I may quote briefly from the Salt Lake Tribune, Peggy Fletcher Stack's article, James Esdras Faust, a counselor in the LDS first presidency known for his passion for justice and quiet ways, died early today at his Salt Lake City home, surrounded by his family. He was 87. He died of causes incident to age, according to an LDS spokesman. Known for his careful, legal mind, his conciliatory ways, and his deep concern for people in trouble, Faust's legacy touches everyone in the 13 million member church. On behalf of the Sunstone Education Foundation, I'd like to extend our condolences to the Faust family. Our sympathies, our thoughts, and our prayers are with them. His passing is a heartfelt loss. After a moment of silence, we will open this session by singing Be Thou My Vision, found on page 34 of the program, after which Elizabeth Quick will offer the invocation. If you'll join me in a moment of silence. Thank you.
Our dear Heavenly Father and Mother, we thank Thee for this unique opportunity to fellowship and explore in such an open-minded, creative forum. Please bless all of the staff, volunteers, and participants who have made this possible. Please bless the family and friends of President Faust with comfort and strength at this time. Please bless the speakers tonight to be moved to speak by the power of the Holy Spirit. Bless us all with clarity, knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. We ask these things humbly in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And thank you to Hardeen Watts and Alan Eastman for helping us with that hymn. Just a quick note, the hymns tonight have been requested by our speakers. The first hymn was requested by Jenna, is that correct? And the closing hymn was requested by John Kessler. Before we begin the Pillars session tonight, we'd like to take a moment and share with you the future of Sunstone. Over the past months and year, we have been deliberating and looking at where we stand today as a foundation. And in the course of any organization, there come times of change, and now is one of those times for Sunstone. For the past 7 years, Sunstone has been led by a executive team consisting of Dan Witherspoon as our executive director and editor, and William Stanford as our publisher. And both of these gentlemen have brought much needed expertise and skills and tone to this foundation, and we are very grateful for what they've brought to us. As we contemplate the future of Sunstone, the board believes that now is a time when we can redouble our efforts, when we can expand our reach, and our vision is expansive, and our goals are pretty high. And to help us realize our vision, and in consultation with Dan, because it certainly affects his position, the board has agreed to split his position of executive director and editor. Dan will continue to deliver the quality content and the tone in the magazine and the symposium as editor. But it's my pleasure to announce that we have a new executive director. We've tapped an infectious and vibrant individual. If you haven't met him, you will shortly. He is the founder of the Mormon Stories podcast, a popular internet radio show that explores Mormonism and Mormon issues in thoughtful, open, and compassionate ways through personal stories. Through his podcast and blog, he's personally collaborated with more than 200 church members struggling with faith issues, and he spends a great deal of his free time counseling with them. Professionally, he has worked for 14 years in the computer industry, including 7 at Microsoft, and he currently works for MIT as the director of the OpenCourseWare initiative. So on behalf of the board of directors, and to share with you our strategic vision, it's my pleasure to present Mr. John DeLynn.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Rory. It's indeed an honor and a privilege to be here in front of you today. It was 3 years ago, 2 years ago, that I attended my very first Sunstone. I had recently moved from Seattle to Logan after going through a very dark time in my life. I was called as a seminary teacher and wanted to be the best seminary teacher I could be, and so I started studying church history in depth. And I thought I had a pretty good understanding of church history. I thought I knew all the skeletons in the closet. But it didn't take more than 3-4 months before I was sitting at the kitchen table with my wife saying, this isn't what I thought it was. And that was really hard for a fifth-generation Mormon whose entire identity was wrapped up in the LDS Church. Fortunately, a voice in my head said, go slowly. I remembered some fond teachers that I had when I was at BYU. Ted Lyon, Lynn England, Clayton White, Bill Bradshaw, who had introduced me to Sunstone and who had introduced me to some of the thinkers like Lowell Bunyan and Eugene England. And so I grasped for those books. One of the first books I read was Mary Bradford's biography on Lowell Bunyan. The folks who have come out of Sunstone have been instrumental in helping me and many others navigate through those very turbulent waters. Because you can inflict a lot of pain, not only on yourself, but a lot of collateral damage on your families, if you're not able to learn a vocabulary and a support system to help you through those times. And so that's why I'm here today. I'm a big believer in Sunstone, and so it's a great honor for me to be here. We want to talk to you just briefly about Sunstone and its future. We feel it's definitely a spectacular time for Mormonism. Is it not working? It's definitely a spectacular time for Mormonism. There's a stunning amount of information available on the internet regarding Mormonism. If you just Google the word Mormon, you'll see over 8 million sites you can go to or pages that you can go to on Mormonism. If you Google LDS, over 12 million web pages that you can go to. If you go to Wikipedia, which is an online encyclopedia, there are over 3,400 articles that have been spontaneously written by volunteers on the subject of Mormonism. A full editions of the Journal of Discourses are online if you care to inflict punishment upon yourselves. I'm kidding. And if you go to iTunes and type in Mormon under podcasts, you'll find over 40 podcasts dealing with Mormon themes. As Rory mentioned, I have a blog called Mormon Stories, and I started it about the time that I came to Sunstone a couple years ago, and this represents the growth of visitors to my blog for my podcast. It's sort of exponential growth, and the numbers are cut off on the top left, but it's almost 60,000 visits per month, which is pretty big. If you go to YouTube, which has video, you'll find that the top five videos under the term Mormon are very interesting. The very first one is a clip of a cartoon from the Godmakers movie that has been viewed 191,000 times. So between that and a clip called Magic Mormon Underwear and one called The Bible Versus Book of Mormon, which is an anti-Mormon video. There's one called Mormon Erotica, and then there's one called Rappin' Mormon, and that rounds out the top five. I don't know what that all means, but I thought I'd just share with you. There's a vibrant community of Mormon-themed blogs and forums out there. Feminist Mormon Housewives is probably the second or first most popular blog out there. One recent post received over 356 comments just on a single post. It's probably grown to 400 since then. But blogs are just taking off. There's a huge interest in the media for Mormonism. I don't have to tell you that Mormons have been in the news in Time and 60 Minutes, PBS, but also on the Colbert Report, the Daily Show, even South Park has had several features on Mormons. Sometimes you can learn more there than you might learn during the three-hour block. So, and one of the most stunning things of all, to give credit where credit is due, is the increase in candor that we've seen over the past 6 months on Mormonism within the church. Those of you who do take the church news will notice that in the past 6 months they've covered the multiple versions of the First Vision. They've covered the Mountain Meadows Massacre with a sort of a new level in candor. They've covered homosexuality and singles in the church. So it's clear that the church understands that the information's out there, and they either need to get ahead of that information, or the information will get ahead of them. If you go to the newsroom on LDS.org, you'll see some very interesting press releases. One that was particularly interesting to me is called Approaching Mormon Doctrine. Has anybody read that press release? It basically says in Approaching Mormon Doctrine, that's history, but I'm talking about Approaching Mormon Doctrine. It basically says in there, members of the church are not to believe every statement made by a general authority. So I printed that out, folded it up, and I keep it in my standard works, and I take that to Elders Quorum in Sunday school. And to be honest, most of the members in my ward have known that for quite some time. No, they have. I mean, no, I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, what I'm saying is I think we're all growing and learning as these things unfold. So the question is there still a place for Mormonism? Is there a place within Mormonism for a place like Sunstone? So with much drama and anticipation, the answer is yes. I want to begin by talking about our motto, Faith Seeking Understanding. Sunstone is a place that begins with faith. But I sort of want to make it really clear that there are lots of different facets of faith. There are people who have very strong faith, there are people who have weak faith, and there are people who have lost their faith. And many of those people switch roles within those three during various times in their life. And so while we want to make sure that people feel welcome, that the faithful will feel welcome to come to Sunstone, that they won't have their faith attacked or denigrated. And in that way, we're supportive of people's faith and their faith journeys. We also want to make sure and understand that it's about supporting the faith journey, not necessarily faith promoting in the sense of the traditional sort of jargon phrase. And so we start from a position of faith. We respect faith. But we also want to mesh thoughts in the intellect with faith to find a more healthy synthesis. And so that's where we start from. And the board has gotten together, and we've come up with a little vision statement that really doesn't reflect anything different than what Sunstone's been trying to do since it began. An independent forum for open, thoughtful, and constructive discussion of all things Mormon. And so in this presentation, maybe we'll just go through a little bit of each of those terms. To begin with, let's talk about independent. And I'm going to invoke the ghost of Bonner Ritchie, even though he won't want to hear that there's a ghost because he's still with us. But on this notion of independent. And we know it's misspelled. That was just a typo.
And you follow the promise of this item. And that is that, in paraphrasing the ancient Greeks, if the unexamined life is not worth living, the unexamined faith is not worth believing. And so I think that people need to push and analyze and doubt and question and debate. But for me, sensum is for people who do think deeply and creatively and who have questions and who have concerns and want to find other people who share those and talk about it. It's a mechanism to explore and to analyze and to share feelings about the gospel, about life, about social issues that relate to Mormon culture, and give people a vehicle for that kind of demanding inquiry that probably doesn't fit usually in a Sunday school or in a priesthood class or religious society or sacrament meeting. And so it's a place to really, really explore. Not to proselyte so much, not to indoctrinate. I don't like zealots on either the true believer side or the critic side, but a place to explore with dignity and with honor and with compassion and with patience and with tolerance, and an open place to really look at what's important.
There are many players in this drama of Mormonism, and each player plays an important role. The church is obviously central to our discussion, and they play a very important role. But there are also other roles. This is a webpage that I grabbed off of exmormon.org. And they sort of start from the position of saying that the church is false and the church is wrong. And that's pretty much the only type of discussion that's allowed on that forum. If you actually go up to this forum and say something positive about the church, they'll delete your comment. And so, that has a place. It meets the needs of some people, they feel. But it's important to understand how popular that site actually is. This red line that you see on the bottom represents the most popular blog, Mormon blog on the internet called By Common Consent. That's the red bar. The blue bar represents the traffic to exmormon.org over the past year. And so that should give you a sense for how popular that website is and how much traffic it's getting. On the flip side, there's FAIR. It's the apologetic website that also starts from the position that the church is true and then makes the arguments to support that case. It's also a very crucial part, again, of this drama, an important role player in what we're doing. And again, you see how exmormon.org stacks up against FAIR. But the question is, when somebody goes to Google and they're in Sunday school or they're preparing for a lesson, they type in some term, what type of responses do they get and where does Google send them? The truth is it sends them either to LDS.org or to the ex-Mormon forum and maybe sometimes to the apologist sites. But there needs to be another place in that sphere, and that's exactly Sunstone's role. It's an independent place where people can come and feel supported, not feel judged. They'll feel loved, whatever their perspective is, and they'll feel empowered to sort of take their faith, take the information, and then make that decision that works best for them. We're supportive of them if they choose to reaffiliate or to get stronger with the church if they're struggling, or to reinforce their faith if they come with a strong faith. And if they choose other paths, they're all welcome. And it's not our job to try and make them feel like we want to manipulate them, either out or, in other ways that they're not comfortable. And so with that, I'll share one more clip.
Sunstone is not a content phenomenon. It's a process phenomenon. It's a place, it's a forum. It's a place to talk and share. It's not a place to articulate a particular value or point of view that everybody should adopt. It's an open forum, and open forums are always dangerous. Education is dangerous. There's nothing quite so scary as truth, as a new idea, and that's what happens here.
So it's true that sometimes there'll be some heat, sometimes there'll be some frustration, but that's sort of the cost of an independent, open discussion. Open is the second term we wanted to talk about, and this time we'll share a clip from our beloved Albert Peck.
And the trajectory of all those people and all the many other people who joined in that path have come now, so you have a very diverse Sunstone. You have a Sunstone made up of people who are true believers and go to church and pay tithing and go to the temple, people who sort of believe but are not very active, and people who are cultural Mormons, and people who are post-Mormon or non-Mormon or ex-Mormons. And then you want to bring in the non-Mormon scholars. And it's such a diverse group. And, you know, as Art Bassett once said in an article he wrote, how much tolerance can we tolerate? You know, this is a much more diverse group. I came to see it, and I'm sure as all politics is personal, so all philosophy is. I came to see this as Sunstone as an open forum, which is you have a place where people come and talk, and you want honest discussions from everyone who's interested in this conversation, whether they be non-Mormon scholars or believing Mormons, this sort of stuff. And if they're civil and kind and respectful and want to pursue knowledge and stuff, then things can happen here. And I would make the argument that even a true believing Mormon believes that that sort of space is healthy, even though they're making space for people who aren't believing or who are atheistic. And Jean England really came to tag on that, you know, like, yes, that's what we want. And in the ideal, I think that's what Sunstone should be.
Sunstone is welcome to everyone, and all topics are on the table for discussion. And we just want to make sure that that message is not muddled in any way. This is an open place. Thoughtful is the next thing we wanted to make sure and convey. And I was trying to think of the best way to convey this idea. And what I wanted to do is sort of convey to you what it felt for me to come to Sunstone for my first time, the actual symposium. There's lots of blogs, lots of websites, lots of books and journals and magazines. But I can't express to you what it was like to walk around the halls and to meet people personally, you know, like a Mary Bradford or an Armand Moss. And let me just express, share with you Bonner's perspective of the types of people that he likes to see and hang around with. Oops.
Sorry. I remember several pillars of my faith session. I remember one where Toby Pingree and Bill Bradshaw and I think Tom Rogers and the spirit of people like that, brilliant, thoughtful, critical, careful, loving people. Those are my friends. Those are the people I like. Those are the kinds of things that I want to be part of and the kind of people I want to have as my community.
So as I came to Sunstone for the first time, I bumped into Mary Bradford just after reading her book. I've met Jana Reese for the first time this week, but I met Armand Moss. I met Ardeen Watts, had no idea who he was and what a phenomenal man this was. Darius Gray, Ed Kimball, John Hatch, Jan Shipps, Levina Fielding Anderson, John Charles Duffy, Leonard Arrington, who I haven't met but I have deep respect for, Levi Peterson, Martha Bradley, Gary Bergera, Laura Thatcher Ulrich, Margaret Toscano, Paul Toscano, D. Michael Quinn, Ross Peterson, John Solito, Toby Pingree, Bill Bradshaw, a great influence in my life, Albert Peck, and of course Daniel Rector, who has passed on, Newell Bringhurst, Dan Witherspoon, Eloise Bell, Dwayne Jeffrey. You know, this is not just your average group of people. These are good, caring, thoughtful people who care about Mormonism and who in many ways have dedicated very significant portions of their lives to helping people on this journey. And I am thrilled and honored to be able to associate with them through Sunstone. And so for just a moment, I'd like to bring up the lights and ask if everyone who's contributed either in a writing or in presenting or volunteering at a Sunstone or a dialogue sort of journal or symposium, please stand. Again, for me, it's an honor to be able to associate with these people. The final word that we wanted to discuss is constructive. And I thought the best way that I could do that was to share with you an email that I received last week. I get about three of these a week, and this one struck me as one that seemed good to share, that conveys what we mean by constructive. Mr. DeLand, I came across your website by accident, but I found something that I have been searching for a long time. I've been very naive in my faith with what I have been taught. In the last year, I started to realize that my testimony, the testimony that I held to so very close to my soul, was being attacked by what looked and acted like truth, but contradicted what I was taught. I began to feel betrayed. My immediate reaction was one of going to my close friends and family. All that did was make my relationships with them strain to a new high. I realized I was now on an island, all by myself, no one to talk to or pull from. And then something happened just recently. The stake president called me to the stake high council. Very reluctantly, I accepted the call. So here I am, as a member of the stake high council, with serious issues. I've entered a very dark place. I refer to it as a dark place because what I believed was light now seems dark. Now, what strikes me that unifies all these people that send me emails is that they feel alone, desperately alone. They can't go to their spouse. They can't go to their children. They can't go to their parents. They can't go to their ecclesiastical leaders. They can't go to their neighbors. They feel like they're defective. They feel like they're broken. And they feel desperate. I met someone last week who is completely inactive from the church, but doesn't feel like she can have a place to go. And when I recommended Sunstone, she was a little bit even unsure. But the point we're trying to make here is that people are desperately alone. And Sunstone is a place where they can come and not feel judged. It's a place where they can come and talk to people who have been down these roads before, where you can learn about people like Lowell Bunyan, Eugene England, Ted Lyon, and the many other people, all of you who are in the audience. And this is what we aspire to. This is the place we try and be, a constructive place where people can feel supported and uplifted and loved and find their way through this darkness. And it's frankly the reason why I accepted this position, to be there for those and to work with you to help provide a place for these people. So with that, we have several major initiatives we'd like to try and work through. First of all, we want to emphasize the content. We have a rich, wonderful treasure of content from the very beginning up through now. It's a wonderful legacy. But we need to reach a broader audience. To some extent, if we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to keep talking to ourselves and talking to ourselves to a smaller and a smaller audience. We have to find a way to expand and to let people know that they're welcome here and that this place will meet their needs. And so we have sort of a mantra that we've come up with: is it important, is it relevant, and is it constructive? And we want to try and live by that motto. And so we're going to look and try and find ways to make our magazine articles, our presentations at the symposium, aligned with that. We probably are going to shift a bit to increase our emphasis on current events and contemporary issues. In some ways, those types of things, almost journalistic endeavors, really speak to where people are today versus talking about things that may not meet them where they are or where they want to go. And so, in addition, we've talked about some type of project with Mormon Studies for the Masses. If I share Sunstone or Dialogue with, my sister or my dad — I won't say my mom because my mom's pretty savvy. She's here, by the way. Hi, Mom. Oftentimes when they pick up these journals, they feel like they're entering a conversation that's been going on for 30 years. They don't know the names. They don't know the topics. They have no way to sort of come into the conversation. So we need to find a way to ramp them up and bring them into the conversation without alienating those of you who have been subscribing with us for a long time. And so we've already started talking with Dialogue and others about ways that we can sort of maybe do some small writing pieces with maybe some podcast interviews and some video interviews that will sort of explain the major issues within Mormon studies. Magic and the early Mormonism, The translation of the Book of Mormon or Book of Mormon historicity, polygamy, blacks in the priesthood, women's issues, the various branches of the Restoration. If we can provide people with sort of this content to ramp them up, we feel like we can bring them into the discussion and provide something valuable and constructive to make them feel like what we're doing meets them where they are. Right now, there really isn't much of a need, this doesn't exist really right now. And so we think that we can fill that need. Also, we want to start trying to do some features on some of the tougher issues facing Mormons, social issues. And we can talk about that a little later. With all this rich treasure trove of audio presentations and magazine articles, we feel like we can take a lot of that and share them with the new generation. And some of you might say, oh, well, all that stuff said 10 or 20 years ago, is that still relevant today? And so I cherry-picked one small clip from a presentation Eugene England gave, and I'd just like to ask you whether you feel like maybe we could benefit from this council.
This moral decline, like Hamlet's, that is perhaps our greatest loss from the Gulf War, was evident from the early war fever, the kick Saddam's butt parties, including one for BYU students, the dehumanizing of Arabs and Muslims, and attacks on war opponents as traitors, and by Mormons as heretics during the war, and the incessant parades afterwards. One evidence we lost the war spiritually is our defensive bragging about it, which includes no indication we understand or feel the destruction we wrought upon others, and the pain and suffering people in Iraq are still going through, the Kurds who again were aroused by our rhetoric and actions into violent rebellion that has and will cost them dearly, the widows and orphans of tens of thousands of Iraqi soldiers, many still unaccounted for after months of anguish, the children who are dying. After the Civil War, our Civil War, for which there was only one parade, President Abraham Lincoln refused to claim God had been on the Union side, suggesting instead that the war was a punishment for both sides. And he asked that Americans think about the widows and orphans on both sides and bind up the wounds of all with charity for all and malice toward none. We haven't done that. Led specifically by a president who wants to prove he's a man and that we've gotten over the Vietnam syndrome as if the humility and sense of regret we had following that war were a weakness rather than a great strength. The first time in our history that we realized appropriately that we were human and could make mistakes for which we should grieve and repent.
That was, of course, given during the first Gulf War. But I really do feel like we could benefit from all that's been said in the past. There's so many marvelous, inspiring presentations. As I listen to the past Pillars of My Faith presentations or the Why We Stay presentations, I get uplifted and edified in ways that I can't describe. And so we have to figure out a way to share that treasure of information with people, as we're doing, but we could do better. And so we're going to be renovating the website. We have a volunteer who believes so much in Sunstone that he started designing on a volunteer basis a new website for us until we can raise the funds to make this possible. So this is his conception of what our new website might look like. Integrating all the MP3s and the audio files, integrating our blog, integrating past magazine issues so that people can read them online, and bringing that all together in a way to where we can find this information and learn from it and benefit from it. And then finally, we really think that we need to do more regional symposiums and get out there and meet people where they are and build up a more distributed critical mass of supporters. Because a lot of people just can't come here, and so why don't we bring a lot of this goodness and sweetness to them? So is there still a place within Mormonism for Sunstone? I guess I could answer that with another question. Is this a sunrise or a sunset? And the truth is that depends on you and your perspective. You could see it either way, but I see that as a beautiful sunrise. And I would love to join with all of you to help build this new future, because I don't think we've even begun to see the potential that we can have for the members of the church and for others who are in their faith journeys attached to Mormonism. The various churches, I should say. John Hamer. So how can we realize this? We need your support. And there are various ways that you can support. The first and probably most significant way is through donations. We've received over $20,000 in 22. So various donors, and Rory will mention them, we've received $22,000 in donations set aside for matching, which means that for those of you over the next week who are willing to contribute $5, it'll become $10. $100 will become $200. $1,000 will become $2,000. And if you can all step up to help match these funds, we feel like we can set the stage for the money we need to make this happen. For those of you who haven't subscribed, please do, or help a loved one who you think might benefit from some of this, subscribe. Because we're going to be doing more journalism articles, we would love some of you who care passionately about topics within Mormonism to consider writing articles or investigating issues that you care about so that you can contribute those to the magazines. If you have an idea about what we might dedicate a magazine to or part of a magazine to or some articles that you think would be really valuable, we want to hear from you. We need volunteers to help us run symposiums and help us sound during presentations and things like that. We need people to interview to get their stories down. We need people to host local or regional symposiums. And we feel like we need to increase our presence on university campuses. We don't want to try and proselyte because we don't think everybody, you know, Sunstone isn't for everybody. But we do believe that some of the students within universities are in a place where Sunstone could benefit them. And we need to find out a way to reach out to them because they're our future. And I'll end with donations. Did I mention donations already? Sorry, that's just a typo. So I want to end with just very one short clip. This is Scott Kinney, the first editor and one of the six founders of Sunstone. But I think it encapsulates the value of Sunstone to him, to me, and hopefully to some of you.
I feel honored and really blessed because of what Sunstone has done, particularly after I left. I just feel blessed to have been able to participate in it and to be associated with it even now. It's really one of the most important things that ever happened to me.
Thank you very much.
John misspoke, based on the information I gave him. It's 24,000, not 22. You know, it's become infectious, and it's been a fun summer. We started out with a very generous matching grant from Jordan Kimball and Rebecca England. They offered $10,000, and we sent that out in our mid-year giving appeal. Since then, we've had other people step forward and say, "I want to be a part of this," and that's brought it up to the 24,000. That includes Jordan Kimball and Rebecca England. It includes James and Susan Parkinson, Charles Schofield Sr., Kim McCall, and Cole Capener. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We're about two-thirds of the way there. And so anything you can do, help us. We've got a whole slew of volunteers in the next room on a phone bank, but it's not ringing. So when you go out... Yeah. We've also got another fun thing to do, and that is that... Mark and Elizabeth England have done a little bit of an incentive. They make Utah's finest gelato at their store Dolcetti Gelato, 1751 South 11th East. It's a premium Italian ice cream, and they will give a free serving to anyone who donates $20 or more. The coupons are out in the lobby. And they'll give a year supply to anyone who gives $1,000 between Friday and Saturday night. So thank you very much for that. I'm going to embarrass him a little more because we are very grateful. And Jordan and Rebecca, Jordan Kimball and Rebecca England, they've also contributed another $10,000 to help us realize the website. Thank you very much. Now, pillars. Our first speaker tonight is Mr. John Kessler. He's an attorney, a consultant, and a lecturer. He's a founder and executive director of the Salt Lake Center for Engaging Community and speaks and consults regarding community flourishing and transformation. He developed and teaches meditation and related practices called integral thematic practice, reflecting Mormon, Zen, and other influences. He is also a founding member of the Ken Wilber-led Integral Institute and its Politics Center, and founding teacher of the Integral Spiritual Center of the Integral Institute. Mr. Kessler.
Well, I'm humbled by this opportunity to discuss the pillars of my faith tonight. Thank you for the invitation to be here. Those pillars are easy for me to name, but they're difficult to articulate. More than what I believe, these pillars are a reflection of who I am. Hence, I've chosen to spend most of my time this evening sharing personal vignettes, which will hopefully paint a picture of those pillars and how they and I have emerged. After attending an Episcopal church in Salt Lake City as a child until about the age of 12, I returned home one day after a particularly anti-Mormon outburst in a Sunday school class and announced to my parents that I didn't want to go to church anymore. My parents, who were secular in orientation, didn't seem to care much about my reasons. They simply said, okay. Their common denominator regarding religion was that the Mormon church was not a good institution. My mother's father from Norway moved to Salt Lake City with his French-Canadian wife and promptly got swindled by a group of Mormon businessmen. My father's mother, the daughter and sister of presidents of the church, had been taken advantage of in a business transaction by a general authority with whom she had placed her trust. Her brother, Joseph Fielding Smith, had said, "Sorry, can't do anything about it," leaving her as a widow to raise her five kids on her own, too odd and obedient to sue a general authority. My father's grandmother, Kessler, when an orphan teenager, had been forced into an abusive, even tragic polygamous marriage by her uncle, Parley P. Pratt. And yet, my father was about the only one in his family who had walked away from the church. When I learned of the history of church-related abuse in my family some years later, I wondered, why would anyone want to be involved in such an abusive organization with so many dishonest people and weird beliefs? I wonder why my mother's family would stay in Salt Lake when they viewed Mormons so negatively, and why most of my father's family would stay connected to the church when it had experienced such multi-generational abuse. It was all a mystery to me, a real paradox. By the time I graduated from college, I'd moved from agnosticism to atheism. I elected to take a fellowship to do graduate study for a year at the University of Hamburg in Germany in political philosophy. But perhaps more than anything else about the opportunity, I was attracted to the totally independent and unstructured nature of the program. Not only could I significantly design my own course of study, but I would have a great deal of time to penetrate deeper into my own beliefs and sensibilities. I intuited that the deeper I went into myself, the more I would be able to sense some deeper reality. Without a God out there, I wanted to know what was in here. This was my first explicit commitment to a quest for spiritual authenticity. Even though I drank some beer with my new German acquaintances, I spent most of my free time alone in an empty room for 9 months with one goal in mind, to question everything that I knew and had ever known, to uncover if there was something underneath it all, some deeper reality. I spent endless hours, it seemed, explicitly casting aside every unexamined assumption and even observing and exploring the filters of my own mind. Before long, I was in the middle of a process that I don't think I could have stopped if I wanted to. It was like falling into a dark hole where every marker of a known reality had disappeared. I stopped eating much. My hair began falling out, a process which has never stopped since. Physically, I became a shadow of my former self. For a day or two, some months into the process, I don't think that there was any other way to say it, but that I had gone mad, wandering about aimlessly. Yet one day, in some inexplicable way, I hit bottom and found that there was still something there. It was not a foundation grounded in thinking or logic, but a physical resonance, a sort of tuning fork that I could feel or listen to with regard to a situation. It was a sensibility that one might call intuition in the context of a sense of being in a kind of an awe-inspiring sensory connection to everything. Meditation became more valuable to me from that moment on because it focused on the interior arena where my connection with everything external became the most complete, sometimes achieving an experience of complete unity. I learned later that this very sensory physical sense of all things and a practice which accesses it is referred to as nature or physical or psychic mysticism. Its fruits are very similar to what Mormons call prophecy, a sense of things without barriers of space or time. I began to realize that this interior quest was truly a spiritual quest, but one that involved no sense of deity. A few years later, I ended up at Columbia Law School in New York City. I had decided by then that I needed to move into a deeper awareness, another step into spiritual authenticity. I had begun to sense that even though the experience of intuition I had achieved in Germany and the meditative mysticism that I was practicing provided a source of guidance and comfort and, frankly, power, I could still feel my psyche destabilizing, opening to something deeper. I could tell that I needed to descend further, and I knew that I would be moving into an intense period of searching and deepening. I moved into an apartment in Harlem, far from where I would likely run into other law students. With the spare time that I had, I would spend hours meditating and poring over philosophical and religious texts, but mostly meditating, never thinking about the possibility that any sense of God would be a part of my spiritual search. As the framework of my consciousness began to unhinge, I pretty much lost my ability to sleep at night. I would drink Gallo wine at night to knock myself out and drink coffee during the day to stay awake. I felt that I was walking around in a dream. I would retreat to my apartment to engage what seemed like a life and death struggle to settle into some deeper reality as the reality that I was familiar with was dissolving. Some Mormon friends of mine in New York urged me to look at Mormonism. I scoffed initially, but particularly because the heritage of my family was so deeply intertwined with the entire history of the church, I thought I might learn something, assuming that it was probably just a cultural refinement lesson. It seemed absurd, in any event, to pray to a God I couldn't conceive of about things that I didn't believe. After a year of tentativeness in the middle of ongoing meditation, prayer, and searching, I felt I had to reach a conclusion one way or another about the Mormons. Intellectually, I thought that there was no way that I was going to join this church, but I was undeniably moved by the spiritual resonances that I was feeling. So I began meditating, contemplating, and praying in earnest until a week came and went when I was doing little else. Then one night, engaged in prayer, I felt smothered in an all-embracing darkness. I felt as though I was going to be destroyed. In the midst of that darkness, my soul cried out for the God that I had doubted. Almost immediately, I was engulfed in a sea of light. I could suddenly see the Book of Mormon, not in terms of its stories, but I gained instead an instantaneous sense of its spiritual field. It wasn't its literal content, but an experience of the resonances and patterns underlying it. I experienced an alignment with that spiritual field and felt the presence of the Spirit and of God. I also knew through a very subtle whispering, which I heard, that I was supposed to contact my grandmother's brother, Joseph Fielding Smith, who was president of the church at that time, with a specific sense that I must do so because he was going to die. A dramatic experience involving engulfing darkness, bright lights, subtle sounds, and revelatory feedback is referred to in spiritual traditions as the fruits of revelation or subtle or deity mysticism. In the development of my pattern of mystical experience, deity mysticism tends to emerge after nature mysticism. My meditation and prayers ever since have in part cultivated that type of communing, revelatory mysticism, which is central to the Mormon tradition. In any case, when I woke the next morning, I got up and wrote my Uncle Joseph a letter telling him that I was joining the church and was directed to see him before he died. I pushed that letter to the back of my desk and let it sit there for a few weeks. During that period, I wondered endlessly about my having fallen prey to what I so much wanted to avoid, a commitment to a faith or a worldview based on a desperate need to believe in something rather than staying open to ever-deepening awareness and integrity, especially related to an institution which had abused my family. Authentic deity mysticism experiences are not uncommon, and people receive very different messages which lead them in different directions, and I knew this. Nevertheless, I finally decided to go ahead and get baptized, even though I could not accept the literalness of many aspects of the faith. On the other hand, I had gotten to the point of looking beyond concepts to trusting the deeper resonances, and on that deeper level, all systems were go. So I dropped the letter in the mail to Uncle Joseph, got baptized the next time I was in Salt Lake City. After being baptized, I visited Uncle Joseph, and the lights went out. And I'll hold on just for a second. The darkness descended again. He welcomed me warmly. I visited his home, and he welcomed me warmly even though we had never met. He was extremely frail. He listened to my concerns about doubting literal aspects of the church and its truth claims. Although weak, he was lucid. He smiled and gently, and in so many words, told me the following: who I am is even more important than what I precisely believe, and that what I manifest based on who I am would demonstrate my actual belief. He counseled me to exercise faith and to align with the Spirit, and the truths I needed to know in the ways I needed to know them would settle into me and bring me peace and joy. And they eventually did. He encouraged me to be godly in all that I did, to walk humbly before God, to love wisely by and through the Spirit, and do my best to bless the lives of others. I certainly had no comeback to that. He died the next day, and I committed myself to do the things he counseled as best I could. I don't know why. Perhaps I had been an unusual lost sheep with a great uncle who was a prophet and someone who had had a dramatic conversion experience, but I soon experienced something like being on a roll in the church, so to speak. Just a few years after I was called, after my baptism, I was called to be a bishop of a student ward at the University of Utah. In the meantime, one could go into the visitor center at Temple Square and find a room playing a recording of me talking about the revelatory experiences that had led me to join the church. Perhaps even more significant, I shared that story in an essay published in the very first Sunstone. Of course, my fiancé was Peggy Fletcher's roommate, and she was desperately looking for material. I found myself regularly being called out of the audience of state conferences to bear my testimony and spontaneously comment on some gospel topic. It all seemed surreal for someone who had been an atheist only a few years before. A handful of years later, when I was still in my 30s, out of the blue came an offer to become the regional general counsel for the church for Great Britain, Eastern and Western Europe, and Africa. So my wife Colleen and I and our two young kids moved to Frankfurt, Germany. I agreed to a 3-year contract, but felt that it might lead to an international career with the church that would enable me to help make a global impact for a church to which I had decided to dedicate my life. I was very impressed with Joseph Worthlin, the area president. What struck me most deeply about him was similar to what I felt in the presence of Neil Maxwell, the other general authority that I had gotten to know well, beginning when he was my professor at the University of Utah. When I was with President Worthlin, no one was there. By that I mean, despite his having a distinct and powerful personality, he had no ego, no personal agenda. He didn't dwell on the past or the future, only what would be wise and compassionate thing to do in the moment. He didn't seem to have what I would call a quickness of mind, but his judgment and decisions were amazingly wise, even prescient. He was a person deeply aligned with the Spirit. I was impressed by his example that a person committed to a lifelong spiritual practice does transform into a being of a higher nature and deeper awareness and broader and wiser field of caring. After about a year into the job, it became increasingly evident that even after being in Western Europe for decades, the church had not complied with many rules and regulations, and some of its representatives were even behaving illegally at times. I found out that the chief auditor for the church was thinking about developing a legal and risk compliance audit, and I suggested that one of the Western European countries be one of the two pilot areas for the study. He agreed, and Portugal was selected. I helped to design the audit instrument. This would really help the church turn a corner and be a mature and legally responsible organization across the board, I thought. The church's general counsel flew to Frankfurt in order to travel with me to review the audit results in Portugal, and widespread illegality in the way the church and its representatives functioned was undeniable. When nothing happened after about a month, I called the church auditor to see what was going on. He described how the general counsel had been politically successful in shutting down the program, and that the auditor had appealed to the top church hierarchy and had lost the political battle. I appealed through my channels to the general counsel's office and was told to abandon this course of action and to allow everything to go on as before, even in Portugal. I appealed to President Wirthland. He commiserated but said some things take time, but he expressed his appreciation for my trying to get the ball rolling. He was sure in the long run that things would begin to move in the direction that I was urging. My problem was that even though Elder Wirthland was the ecclesiastical administrative head of that area of the church, I reported professionally to the general counsel's office in Salt Lake City. I didn't feel that I could in good faith preside over systematic illegality and not be authorized to aggressively try to make it better. This was a huge moment because Elder Maxwell was encouraging me to stay with the church professionally for the long haul, as was President Wirthland. Nevertheless, after much agonizing, I asked the general counsel's office to find a replacement and went back to Salt Lake City almost a year before the expiration of my contract. It was viewed in the church hierarchy that I had deserted my post. I was brokenhearted but felt that to do anything different would require an intolerable lack of integrity. I did hear as years went by that the issues I was concerned about did get addressed more adequately. No one saw me smile much for the next few years. I was literally in mourning. I was now personally living the paradox of my family heritage, feeling in agony because of the church and yet staying connected. I told no one who wasn't intimately involved in my decision why I came home. My trust in human nature, even human nature high in the church, had taken a blow, and I never wanted to work for the church again. Nevertheless, my spiritual practice in the church was not shaken. I had learned to live by and through the Spirit in the context of that institution. It made my life, and for the most part, the life of those around me, better, happier, and more productive. In any case, I was pleased to be called as a scoutmaster as my next church assignment, and happily tromped around the woods for the next several years with my son and other boys. At that time, frankly, nothing was more satisfied than working with boys and spending a lot of time in nature, praying, contemplating, and meditating, and pursuing my mystical bent. About 5 years later, some significant aspects of my life came crashing down around me all at the same time. One element of it was financial. I sold everything that I owned, including my house, and cashed in my retirement to cover debts created by a company. A client of mine had just invited me to be chair of their board, and then it promptly collapsed amid some scandal. The other principals either declared bankruptcy or headed for the hills. I decided to try to make it right with every creditor, and hundreds of thousands of dollars were still owing after exhausting all of my resources. I was able to get into a house after about a year and began a 10-year process of paying those debts, as well as building, living in for a while, and then selling houses with my wife in charge of those things while I worked at the law. Being broke, feeling disgraced, and dragging my family from house to house to apartment to basement to house and so forth, I was in a stressful situation for a long time. The foundations of my male pride, of professional success, of taking care of one's family had pretty much collapsed. My hope of being some kind of major societal change agent during my prime years was gone, which had been a really big deal for me, but that is a whole different story. Surviving psychologically became a matter of getting up every day and doing what was before me and not existing in the past or the future. Focusing on dwelling entirely in the moment became everything. During this time, something unexpected began to happen in terms of my awareness. In the midst of the trauma and the hassles, I began to notice that sometimes I was watching myself go through the motions. It was like being a spectator at a movie, and I was just one of the actors in the film I was watching. I would watch myself talk, and I would even watch myself think. In other words, there was an I that was deeper than the I that I thought I was, an identity related to pure witnessing. This new aspect or level of consciousness phased in over many years. During times of prayer and meditation, I would sometimes experience a cessation of anything in the field of awareness, a new experience related to this state of witnessing. It also yielded a state of calm and peace that is indescribable, that one can only maintain, that one can maintain even amid chaos. In the great traditions, this state of witnessing and then merging with all that is witnessed is called awareness or causal mysticism. It tends to arise stably after nature and deity mysticism have both emerged and stabilized. This is a mysticism which emphasizes the aspect of being the egoless witness or seer, who sees things more the way they really are without the filter of the small ego. In the church, we tend to see the role of the seer as an exalted office to which one is called, but it also relates to a core modality of mysticism and attainment of nirvanic peace to which more Latter-day Saints might explicitly aspire if we had the practices to support it. It was during this period that I began to seriously explore and better understand the full spectrum of developmental aspects of human life and growth. This helped me recognize many indicators of not very high developmental center of gravity of the church and in the church, in spite of a commitment in the faith to lifelong development towards godliness. During this period, I came to feel somewhat alienated. I remained, quote, active, but because we moved around every year or so for a decade, very few members picked up on the deepening feelings of alienation. Nevertheless, I continued to drink even more deeply from the well of worship and meditation, at what one might call a Mormon mystical path. In the meantime, a totally unexpected development related to my spiritual integration occurred. Perhaps the most influential Zen leader of Zen Buddhism in the West, the head of the largest Zen lineage headquartered outside of Japan, Genpo Roshi, developed a remarkable dialogue-based process to facilitate people into a big mind state called the big mind process. Big mind is one of many terms used for the state of non-dual awareness that is described in several Eastern traditions as enlightenment. Big mind is a state of consciousness that I was not familiar with other than through reading a description of it. I had read a fair amount of Zen writings over the years, for instance, and I thought I had a basic, quote, understanding of the Zen outlook. I really didn't get it, though, when it has to experience big mind. There is no organized practice in the Mormon tradition nor any other practice I had experienced to that point which had opened me up to the big mind experience. Within a few months of when Genpo Roshi first discovered the big mind process, I attended a workshop for mediators in which he facilitated a demonstration of the process in a breakout session that I happened to wander into. I experienced that big mind state so powerfully that I could barely function for almost 2 weeks as I pretty much remained in big mind for that entire period around the clock. I have studied and practiced the big mind process and other supportive practices ever since as an aspect of personal psychological and awareness development and refinement. After 4 years of teaching and training hundreds, perhaps thousands of others in this process around the world, Genpo Roshi had only certified 4 people to lead large groups in big mind facilitation: 2 abbots of Zen monasteries, a woman Buddhist monk who has since received transmission as a Zen teacher, and myself. In terms of mystical training and progression, stabilizing and becoming deeply familiar in the non-dual state is the arena of final achievement in the spectrum of meditative and mystical maturity in the major traditions after nature, deity, and awareness mysticism. In any case, after practicing deeply in big mind and transcendent states accessed, quote, on the other side of big mind, as I call it, that I found myself fully able to re-engage in the church with no reservations whatsoever. The paradox had evaporated into some kind of unity. Literally, my energy changed, and I promptly found myself on a high council and a couple of bishoprics over this past decade. So what are the pillars of my faith? The first pillar is the depth and authenticity of the spiritual field. The spiritual field that I encountered in a dingy apartment in Harlem in the early 70s is deep and rich, and as far as I can tell, unlimited, and invites each of us to explore and deepen in the wisdom and compassion and presence of the Spirit. It enables each one of us to become prophets, revelators, and seers, and to advance into multidimensional ways towards godliness. The more deeply I have explored and experienced this field, the richer and more profound it has become to me. It constitutes the patterns, energies, and resonances with which I experience everything. It is who I am. It makes manageable and even transcends my personal and family paradox. It is also my testimony that who I am and ultimately that field includes causal and non-dual resonances, which I am committed to sharing and spreading in the Mormon community and, frankly, in the world at large. The second pillar is that the gospel is open to truth everywhere. As Joseph Smith taught, truth is circumscribed in one great whole, which implies that every perspective is partial. Every additional perspective and understanding adds to an appreciation of the whole, even as the whole is ultimately unknowable in any cognitive sense. Each new facet that I peer through is so exciting to me, and in the end, with the aid of the Spirit, always tends to confirm and further my deepening within and integration of this spiritual field. It is my faith that the restored gospel is not a container of beliefs and dogmas, but invites us to be open to truth and complementary practices wherever we can find them. There has always been and remains a strain of commitment in the church to an open canon that can benefit from the wisdom of other traditions. For instance, I look to my great-grandfather, Joseph F. Smith, whom President Hinckley has suggested had the deepest grasp of the restored gospel of anyone except Joseph Smith, the founder. President Smith said, "We believe in all truth, no matter to what subject it may refer. No sect or religious denomination in the world possesses a single principle of truth that we do not accept or that we will reject. We are willing to receive all truth from whatever source it may come. In this context, I hope to continue practicing as well as being a catalyst in the church as best I can to this openness and passion for truth wherever it may be found." The third and last pillar is that the restored gospel is ultimately about growth, development, and integration. To me, the deeper currents of the Mormon tradition have to do with the growth, development, and integration into godliness, and as we Mormons would say, into godhood. Whether it is physical, emotional, moral, mental, or spiritual development, whether it is the impetus to evidence such growth by losing oneself in the service in the world, or optimizing one's capacities for godliness through internal tantric development and with one's partner, the restored gospel contains unparalleled richness and depth. It is my belief that to the extent we adopt more practices in the Mormon tradition, which more explicitly help each of us move along the developmental track to godliness in multidimensional ways, to which the Savior has invited us. In addition to more successful sharing the restored gospel, Mormons will, among other things, emerge as dominant leaders in global human rights and environmental justice, as well as engaging civically in ways that will transform the qualities of our community life across the world and the world itself. In any case, I plan to spend the rest of my life working toward that end. It is on these pillars that my testimony rests, and it is in this context that I feel blessed to currently serve as a ward missionary, to teach a gospel essentials class, and to be actively working to introduce the gospel to others. It is my testimony that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, that the Savior would have us, each of us, become one with Him in every sense of that word, and respectively to become priests and priestesses, and like our Mother and Father in heaven, gods and goddesses. It is my testimony that President Hinckley is a prophet, revelator, and seer for the world, and that today the world lost a great prophet, seer, and revelator in President James E. Faust. And I say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you. Next, we're going to be privileged to hear from Jana Reese. Jana has been the religion book review editor for Publishers Weekly since 1999. She holds degrees in religion from Wellesley College and Princeton Theological Seminary, and a PhD in American religious history from Columbia University. She's the author or co-author of 6 books. She speaks often to media about issues pertaining to religion in America and has been interviewed by the Associated Press, Time, Newsweek, People, the Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Times and Newsday, among other print publications, as well as Voice of America, The Today Show, and NPR's Morning Edition and Talk of the Nation. She's married to Phil Smith. They live in Cincinnati, Ohio, with their daughter, Jerusha.
In your hearts, sanctify Christ as Lord. Always be ready to make your defense to anyone who demands of you an accounting for the hope that is in you. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, New Revised Standard Version. I wrote a satirical article for Sunstone sometime last fall on how not to give a talk in sacrament meeting. So it must necessarily follow that having been critical once myself of the substandard Mormon talk, which begins with a prolonged discussion of where you were and what you were doing when you received the dreaded call to speak, describes your nervous apprehension in excruciating detail, and then utilizes the remaining minute and a half to use a Webster's Dictionary definition of the assigned topic. So I've opened myself up to criticism of any talk that I will henceforth give in any Mormon setting. I think that part of the repentance process for writing satire is to then be asked to participate in whatever it is that you've just made fun of. So for the record, I was folding laundry when Bishop Dan called me this spring, and I was quite surprised by the invitation because I'm only in my 30s, and I thought, well, that would be something later in life. So it's very thrilling for me to be here. And being a good little Mormon, I had to go up and look up pillars in the dictionary. Now, Webster's is the canonical dictionary for birthright Latter-day Saints. But if you're a convert like me, there's a little bit of latitude there, so I used an online version, and I hope that that is okay. So here's what I found about pillars. Definition 1, a slender, freestanding vertical support, a column. Well, it was hard for me to see how definition 1 really applies to me. I am supportive, I am certainly freestanding and independent, and I'm mostly vertical since I joined the LDS Church and became a teetotaler. Slender, maybe not as much, since I joined the LDS Church and became a teetotaler. There have to be compensations. So, definition number 2, let's try that. Number 2, a pillar, one who occupies a central or responsible position, a pillar of the state. Sort of. I'm a writer and an editor, and in that capacity I do have a central and responsible position in the shaping of public opinion, sometimes. And as regards my faith, I certainly hope that my faith is strong and centered on the core, Jesus Christ. But in thinking about it, I realized that the image of a pillar is just not the best metaphor for describing my faith. So forgive me as I blithely set aside a long-standing pillars of my faith tradition at Sunstone and invent my own metaphor. To me, a pillar is strong, but it is also inflexible and impossible to move. Pillars don't recognize when they are positioned in the wrong places. They are respected precisely because they are fixed, unchanging, undeviating. My faith, on the other hand, is unfixed. It is centered, but also open to new possibilities. My faith is not, and I hope never will be, made of marble or granite. If it had been remotely pillar-like back when I was an evangelical Christian during and after college, I would never have been open to reading the weird, wild, and wonderful book that changed my life, which was the Book of Mormon. And if it were pillar-like now that I am a Mormon, I think I would be an insufferably self-righteous git. So I had to set about finding my own metaphor, my own DIY metaphor project. And I've settled on the image of flowing water. I'm here to speak about five tributaries of my faith. And for this metaphor, I'm drawing on Richard Foster's book, for those of you who know his work, mostly because I recommend it any time I've ever asked to speak about anything. You know, it's always relevant. And the book is called Streams of Living Water, Richard Foster, and he in turn is drawing on the Gospel of John when we learn that out of a believer's heart will flow streams of living water. Tributaries of faith are those moving waters that lead to the community, which is the river, which is all of us. A tributary is small, it's energetic, it's constantly changing as a flow of water. It's in perpetual motion, but it doesn't lose sight of its end goal, which is to contribute something to the river. Like the tributary, my faith is sometimes in flux, but I believe that to be a good and healthy thing. It is usually moving forward and tripping over such obstacles as it may find in its wake. My faith contributes to the river that is the LDS Church, which is also, I should point out, constantly in motion, and that in turn has something to offer to the wide and salty sea that is the body of Christ. Like the tributary, my faith does not exist to serve itself, but to contribute something to the river and to the sea. Sometimes my faith takes a little detour. With tributaries and rivers, this is a known and expected phenomenon called a meander. Raise your hand if you, like me, never knew this was a noun. It is a noun as well as a verb, apparently. A meander is how the water responds when it finds resistant material present on the banks. I have learned in my faith journey to welcome these meanders and not be afraid, knowing that they are an essential part of the faith journey. As a convert, I am sometimes saddened by the narrow views many Mormons have about doubt. Conservative Mormons I meet seem to suggest that doubt is dangerous, that it's something to be feared and something to be avoided, since it could cause someone to lose a testimony. I mean, you have to wonder what sort of testimony that was in the first place if it is so easily lost. But the flip side is also true. Many liberal Mormons have so taken this to heart that when they began the organic and perfectly natural process of questioning belief, then they lose their footing entirely and imagine that they are somehow spiritually lacking. Some of them leave the church for this reason, including a few people I know and hold dear in this very room. I hope that more of us can move away from the model of just this linear progression of faith, that there is a single, straight as an arrow line to follow, and think about faith as more of a river. If you're not testing and growing and changing, then maybe something is wrong. As Heraclitus taught us, it is impossible to step into the same river twice. It was hard for me to narrow my faith down to five tributaries, and I wound up throwing out quite a lot of them that I originally had. The ones that I've chosen to highlight are restoration, which is the longest part of the talk. So if you're sitting here thinking, she's only on number one, don't despair, because the other ones are much shorter. So restoration, renewal, responsibility, relationship, and redemption. You'll notice the gimmick that all of them begin with re, so I left out a few that don't apply to me, like Republican. And I also omitted a couple that do apply but don't have time to talk about, such as repentance and revelation, which have both been very, very pivotal parts of my spiritual journey. In this section on restoration, it's long because I'm sharing my own conversion story, or some of it, as well as talking about the concept of restoration and what we mean by that. As I shared this afternoon on the atheism panel, I grew up in an atheist/agnostic family. We had all of the views. And organized religion was regarded with deep suspicion, even derision. And yet, even as a small child, I remember just being fascinated by religion. I would go to Girl Scout sleepaway camp, and then on Saturday night, I would go to the optional Catholic Mass and take communion. And on Sunday morning, I would go to the optional Protestant service just to see what it was like. I mean, that's just bizarre. I don't know what that was about. Now, regarding Mormonism, my first impression was really not actually that positive. I was heading into seventh grade, and I signed up for a summer course, a two-week course called College for Kids, and this particular class was was Nauvoo and the Mormons. I had never heard of Nauvoo, and I had only the vaguest possible idea of what a Mormon might be, but the course description had these two magic words, field trip. And so I signed up, because even though I was desperate to get out of the small Midwestern town I grew up in, you know, I was eager to go to a smaller Midwestern town to spend the day. During those 2 weeks, we were supposed to read parts of the Book of Mormon and parts of Joseph Smith's history. We watched a lot of really cheesy film strips in class, which maybe you have also seen. But then on the last day, we drove about 80 miles to go to Nauvoo. We saw Carthage Jail, we had cookies at the little bakery, and then we went to both of the visitor centers, both RLDS and LDS. And it was there, at the LDS visitor center, that I had my first impression of Mormon womanhood. There was a room, this is my memory anyway, my 11-year-old memory. There was a room that was dedicated to Mormon womanhood, and there was, you know, there were photographs and quilts and very beautiful things. And then there was this enormous portrait of Marie Osmond and her mom that just dominated a wall with a caption of that Marie and her mother were, you know, paragons of virtue of Mormon womanhood. And, you know, I wasn't all that impressed with it, but I was even less impressed when I went back to Nauvoo in high school, and it was gone. That photo of Marie that I remembered so vividly was gone because she'd had a divorce. This was my first impression of Mormon womanhood, that there was almost no forgiveness for poor choices or, you know, adolescent behavior. You're off the wall, babe. That's it. Sorry, Marie. And yet, I kept returning to Mormon theology in high school and then especially in college. I went to Wellesley and I began reading because I had a couple of Mormon friends that I respected very much. They lived for principles I admired, even though they had beliefs that I considered to be bizarre. I wound up doing my senior religion thesis on Mormonism and American politics. And then the following summer, challenged by a female missionary that one could only describe as cantankerous, I agreed to read the Book of Mormon and to accept a visit from two sister missionaries who were actually really cool. I didn't make any decisions during that summer, even though I started having a very profound spiritual experience of the Book of Mormon. It was a really tough thing because I was about to head off to become a pastor. I was going to seminary, and by that I don't mean early morning Mormon seminary, but the kind where you actually study Greek and Hebrew and you're working toward being ordained as a minister. So I was on this ordination track. I was getting ready to get married to my wonderful Protestant husband. It really was an inconvenient time to suddenly throw all that into question and become a heretic. And yet when I got to seminary, I found myself writing all my papers on Mormonism and working through these issues. I would sit in the Firestone Library stacks at Princeton University, and I would just pull things off the shelves randomly. Journal of Discourses, which someone said here would be a chore to read. I actually enjoyed. Not all of it, clearly, but some. You know, Dialogue. It was my first experience with Dialogue, and now I'm on the board of directors, which is amazing. Biographies of the Prophets, The Ensign. I would just pull things down, not even really knowing what they were, and sit there for hours and read. Through all of this, I gradually had to admit that it wasn't just an academic interest, but also a very deeply personal one, and that despite all my best intentions, I'd fallen in love with the Book of Mormon and with the Mormon people. It took me a really long time to be baptized, though. I still had a lot of doubts. I read and I reread Alma 32, which is still one of my favorite passages of Scripture, about faith and about doubt. And I decided that my faith, so nascent, needed to be experimental. So I needed to do something instead of just waiting for something to happen. I started keeping the Word of Wisdom about 6 months before my baptism, taking literally its notion that it was for the least of all the saints. I figured, that's me. I also went to my first Sunstone Symposium in Washington, D.C. And I continued reading Sunstone and Dialogue, as well as Ensign and other faith-promoting materials. But it was so critical for me to know that if I did choose to be baptized, I would not have to check my brain at the door. I owe that to this community. I was finally baptized in the fall of my senior year, the auspicious month of September, 1993. And you can imagine, having been reading the New York Times and trying to keep up with what was going on in Mormonism while I was in New Jersey trying to make this big decision, it was very confusing because I was seeing these high-profile excommunications of historians and feminists whose work I had admired. And so as I was heading into the water, one of the things that I was thinking was that although there may not be a place for me in the LDS Church, I know that this is what I'm supposed to do. And I knew the Lord was leading me. I thought, I will be a pioneer like all of those pioneers that I read about in Mormon history. However, I overlooked the very important caveat that it totally sucks to be a pioneer, which anyone who's ever read Mormon history seems to know. I kind of missed that part. Those first couple years of being a Mormon were very, very lonely for me. I had made this huge change in my life. And culturally, please believe me when I say that it was no small thing for me to consider forever uniting myself with a people for whom pastel-colored marshmallows were required in every salad. And theologically, I was just still trying to work out my faith. It was hard for me to even talk about my Mormon conversion to other people, especially in the seminary setting. One of the only people that I told at the time that I was still a student in seminary was a gay friend of mine who had come out to me the year before, hands trembling and voice shaking. So I revealed my secret religious identity to David, hands trembling and voice shaking in a crowded cafeteria. His initial response, because he had been raised in a very conservative, theologically conservative Protestant community and was still very theologically conservative himself, was to say, "This woman is joining a cult! I have to save her!" And then his second response, which was just pure compassion, was, "This woman just came out to me." And then he and I sat, and I told him my conversion story and what had happened to me, and he just responded with tremendous support and love. These were words that I needed to hear at that time, because apart from my husband, who took this completely in stride, other friends and family members were confused and didn't really understand. Ultimately, I knew I had to just be true to myself and kept reminding myself of this line from Goethe, that if we trust ourselves, we will know how to live. Now, for me, the conversion process was and is, because it is ongoing and it should be for all of us, fraught with theological problems and sometimes vexing questions. And one of the most vexing for me was this issue of what do Mormons mean when they use the term restoration? So I'd like to think aloud about this for just a moment. When I was a kid, my parents decided that they wanted to restore the 1896 Victorian house that we lived in. And apparently it was just so much fun for them that they bought another house of the same era, and we spent our summer afternoons doing that house. And so I spent these summers learning how to sand and stain floors, plaster, paint, strip wallpaper. We did everything ourselves. And my experience restoring houses has caused me to think a good deal about what we mean as Mormons by the word restoration. Restoration of the gospel, the restored Church of Jesus Christ. I don't think that many Mormons have actually restored that many historic houses. The goal in historic restoration, which is a little bit distinct from a rehab or a renovation, is to bring things back to their original pristine state. When you restore a home, you don't tear it down to the foundations, and you don't build a McMansion on the same spot. You assume that what is there has structural integrity and is worth preserving. You take off, all of the horrid wallpaper from the 1970s and the shag carpeting, and you get down to the original wood floors, but you're not raising the house to its foundations. Recently, my husband, who is Episcopalian now, he was Methodist and now Episcopalian, Protestants do that. He came with me to a testimony meeting where this very, very sweet Mormon guy expressed his profound gratitude for being a member of, quote, the only true and living church on the face of the earth, unquote. And Phil and I grinned at each other, and I turned to him and I said, sweetheart, you better hurry. You're going to be late for the service at your false and dead church. And I'm sure that if we had asked that very kind Mormon brother, whom I know to be a wonderful person, what he meant by asserting membership in the only true and living church, he would probably soft pedal that, and so he should. I worry that Mormons have no inkling of how their words sound outside of the Mormon enclave. How would we imagine that such rhetoric is going to be heard by anyone else? As we think here at Sunstone about the public face of Mormonism, I think one of the issues that we can confront is how to express radical, exclusive truth claims in ways that are not so off-putting. So for the record, and my daughter, Jerusha, who is here, I wanted to bear my testimony for her, because at age 8, she is trying to navigate the complexities of this Mormopalian family that she finds herself in. That's very, very confusing. I want to bear witness that I do believe deeply in the restoration of the gospel. And to be clear, what I mean by that is that God has broken into history in an alarming way by aiming to perfect the Christ story in us, in our institutional church and our individual hearts. I believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, not in a cheap and innocuous manner of a church video, but in a very hard-won Old Testament way, where a frustrated God chooses one who is willing to serve, despite personality flaws or limited understanding. I believe in a loving but absurdly human Joseph Smith, who had the courage to risk everything as God required. I believe that the LDS Church today is poised to contain the fullness of the gospel of Christ, whenever we, as individual members of it, are prepared to accept his invitation to participate in redeeming the world rather than merely reveling in our unearned status as chosen people. Now, how we cooperate in the world's redemption brings me to the second tributary of my faith, which is renewal. By renewal, I mean spiritual rejuvenation through concrete, regular spiritual disciplines, such as prayer, Sabbath keeping, fasting. All of these invite us back to God and give us a rhythm for the days, weeks, months, and years. I think that in Mormonism, we have a wonderful tradition of emphasizing the vital importance of the spiritual disciplines. We want to do it right. But the flip side of that emphasis is that too often Mormons adopt a legalistic view of spiritual practice. What matters is that you do it correctly, not that you're changed by it or you're learning and growing from the practice. We need to guard against that kind of dead legalism and rote religion. We also need to guard against, ironically, our unstinting activism. Please don't get me wrong about this, because one of the things that I love most about Mormonism is how tied we are to the redemption of this world. We are here to serve one another. But what we lack, and what Christian history can teach us, is the equally important value of contemplation. Holding action and contemplation in balance is one of the greatest calls of the Christian life. For me, about every year or 18 months, as I have the time, I have been going on retreat for a few days at the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky. This was Thomas Merton's abbey, for those of you who are familiar with his work. These times have become a deep well of renewal for me. I love the solitude and the silence. I've discovered, though, that retreat is a word that many Mormons simply don't understand. I think that as a people, we only advance. In Relief Society, a sister asked me, what do I possibly do for 4 days on a silent retreat? And I realized as I was opening my mouth to answer her that the truth, which is mostly thinking, just would open up a whole can of worms and would not satisfy her. So I told her another truth, which is that I bring along several theology books and novels and my computer so I can read and write. I've discovered that many lifelong Mormons just don't have a frame of reference for understanding a contemplative religious retreat as a valuable thing in and of itself. I would love to see more room for contemplation and solitude, and retreat in Mormonism. I want to come now to the crux of the chiasmus of my five tributaries, which is responsibility, agency, and its twin, accountability. I was in church recently, and a visiting member of the Stake High Council declared very emphatically that obedience was the first principle of the gospel. And I would counter just as emphatically that it's agency, not obedience, that is the first principle of the gospel. According to the Mormon story, God sacrificed a whole heck of a lot so that we could enjoy freedom and choice, as well as responsibility and accountability. In no other way could we grow. Through no other method could we become like God, through our screw-ups, our loving moments, and our very, very hateful ones. The Mormon God is not looking for automatons who abdicate their own spiritual responsibility to others. In fact, in Mormonism, we have scriptures that say, hello, that was Satan's plan. God wants us to grow up. Theologically, I see Mormonism as a religion that blithely passes out car keys to eight-year-olds, and I mean that as a compliment. So much is given to us, belief in divine nature, which is radical, and then the ultimate claim, the idea that we actually chose to come here, to take up this mortal life with all of its pain. We Mormons can never say we didn't sign up for this. Agency for me helps resolve many of the issues of theodicy and blame in the world. How suffering and evil can exist so flagrantly in a world that God both created and declared to be good. The agency model places the uncomfortable weight of suffering often right back on our own shoulders. I've seen in my own family how disastrous personal choices can bring terrible suffering to ourselves and others, even suffering that many people would blame squarely on God, for example, a tsunami or an earthquake or Hurricane Katrina. Some of us are starting to see through a Mormon lens. As we learn more and more about human greed and how it and the lust for power are changing our very environment. I don't want to get too political here, but I do believe that more natural disasters are possible, possibly likely, if wealthy nations continue to put our fists in our ears and refuse to see the warning signs as we, through our agency, chip away at the world that God created. Now that's agency on a macro level. On the micro level, where most of us actually live, agency is at work in all of our choices and our relationships. And this is why I have a very strong testimony of the word of wisdom. I have lived with alcoholism, and I've lived with addiction in the home. And I am perfectly aware that the great sin of alcohol and drugs is not just what they do to our bodies, which we as Mormons believe are God's temple, but what they do to our souls. Anyone who has ever lived with an addict has witnessed the tragic destruction of the soul as addicts make daily Faustian bargains and trade their souls for a mess of pottage. It is horribly, horribly sad. And if I feel sad, I can only imagine how God must feel. As beloved children exchange the freedom that God worked so hard to create for us for bondage and slavery. For me, a final aspect of agency that's been critical is one of our articles of faith. We will be punished for our own sins and not for Adam's transgression. Mormonism has allowed me to radically reinterpret the fall, since I felt damaged by a Catholic and Protestant understanding of Eve as a temptress and the sole source of human ruination. In the Mormon story, Eve is rewritten as a courageous inductor of humanity. But more than doing away with the stain of original sin, the Mormon belief in agency frees me from a family history that can sometimes, quite honestly, feel really devastating. It gave me the courage to start a family of my own when all of those old scripts in my family of desertion and divorce and addiction, all that cheery stuff, were rolling. I've shared at Sunstone before how this teaching of not being responsible for Adam's transgression also, about 10 years ago, helped me when I discovered that all my husband's people come from the same sparsely populated county in Arkansas where the ill-fated Fancher Party got its start as they headed off across the country and became the victims in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And if you know anything about that county in Arkansas, you'll know that it's far more likely that my husband is related to one of those families than it is unlikely. Otherwise, you've never lived in the South. I think that, for now, my Protestant husband and I are both grateful for this Mormon teaching that we will be judged for our own merits and demerits, and not for those who came before us. For freedom, Christ has set us free. Now, that's not to say that Mormonism is encouraging a rugged individualism of solo religion, which brings me to my fourth tributary, relationship. In Mormonism, we exalt the family to unprecedented theological heights, and we aim for nothing less than uniting the whole dang human race through temple ceilings. It's a really ambitious religion. We can't even be fully, completely saved on our own. So it's probably no surprise that for me, relationships feature prominently in my own theology. And this is not unique to me or to Mormonism. I recently read a hilarious and absolutely wonderful book that I've been recommending to everyone I meet. It's this one here. It's coming out in October, called The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. And basically, the author, A.J. Jacobs, decided as a secular Jew that he wanted to try to understand how religion was becoming so important in the world, and that the best way to do this was to live the Bible as literally as he possibly could. So not just, you know, the basics, like not coveting, which is hard enough, or not lying, not gossiping, but things like not mixing wool with linen, or not saying, I'll meet you on Thursday, in the first Thursday in January for breakfast, because you're uttering the names of two foreign gods, which violates a biblical commandment. So on and on and on. And it's a hilarious book. He tries on the subway not to sit in any seat that a woman might have sat in, just in case she might have been menstruating. Very funny. But what's especially beautiful and poignant about the book is that, having never experienced anything remotely like a religious community, he just eats that up as he encounters it for the first time. So on Simchat Torah, he's dancing with the Hasids with the Torah scroll, and he has his twin sons circumcised, and he just delights in meeting these religious people of all stripes, discovering this power of community, that a vital part of religion is simply belonging with people, whether or not we always understand or agree with what they do. One of the book's most illuminating moments for me, in fact, is when Jacobs goes to the Creation Museum, which in Cincinnati we say, that's on the Kentucky side. That's not us. Okay? Everyone says it's in Cincinnati, but it's actually in Kentucky. Anyway, he goes there, and he has this very gracious and generous response, because he recognizes that the appeal of creationism, you know, no matter how abominable it is theologically or biblically or scientifically, that the appeal is about relationships, because it's about linking all of humanity together in a very literal way. Now, Mormonism has given me incredible relational experiences, and I'm going to skip over a little bit of this part because it's just mushy. Just very, very mushy. But I do want to call attention to a few people here who have been so instrumental in my faith, and, you know, a lot of other people here at Sunstone as well. First of all, my surrogate parents are here, Ray and Roberta Black, with whom I stay every time I come to Salt Lake, and they make me feel like a just precious and prized person. And the best home and visiting teacher I ever had, Arian and Dave Dancy, who've just moved here from Cincinnati, and you guys are so lucky to have them because they're just salt of the earth. Chris Bigelow, who's my co-author with the Dummies book, and he's become a really good friend and collaborator on another project as well. And many, many other people here. Kurt Bench is sitting in the back so he can make a quick getaway if he needs to. But I first heard Kurt give this talk a few years ago, and I didn't know him very well, and I was sitting in the back, and thought, that is someone that I want to be friends with. So, you know, Mormon relationships. For me, the most important part of my Mormon story has happened in community of inquiry and discussion and debate and love. Relationships have also been very key for me in dealing with difficult times, which brings me to my final tributary, which is redemption. Mormonism is unique to me because it casts all of life into this holy light and makes the audacious claim that every single experience we have here is something we can use in the hereafter. We can and we do take it with us No other Western religion I've studied makes this explicit claim, although many individual people believe it. What we tend to emphasize in Mormonism is the family relationships that endure beyond the grave. But another less discussed aspect of Mormon theology is that every experience we have here, every joy, every sorrow, every new idea we've ever had will be used and will attend to us in the life to come. When I was a Protestant, one of the notions that just drove me crazy was that an individual was either saved or not saved, and that this one moment of decision was the only thing that mattered in sealing one's eternal fate. As long as the individual had accepted Christ as a personal savior, emphasis on the personal, then he or she would head merrily off into the happy lands at death. And I could never reconcile this with the Bible, that this one culturally conditioned moment would be the sole factor in such a high-stakes game. What about how we treat people? What about how we live and how we behave toward one another? Considering that the Bible is so preoccupied with those questions, it seemed to me profoundly unbiblical to claim that this one salvific choice overrode everything else. And Mormonism, for me, solves this problem very nicely by insisting that both things matter, and in fact that they work together. We accept Christ's atonement, and we respond to that grace by trying the best we can to live the commandments. But Mormonism also redeems the rest of the story, all those other human moments, those billions of other decisions that we make. Nothing, not one experience is going to be lost. This is a perfectly shocking theology. Not one thing we do is irrelevant. It's really scary, actually. But I also find it immensely comforting. All the painful experiences that I had as a child, including the loss of knowing my grandmother, who was killed when I was very small, and the loss of my father, who abandoned us when I was 14 in order to find himself. I think he is still looking somewhere. These early losses not only made me who I am as a person, but that they will continue to shape me throughout the eternities is a revelation to me. And there are more recent losses, small things maybe, but the loss of a beloved dog who died in June, almost shy of her 16th birthday, and a miscarriage that I had 3 weeks ago. And I would say that in terms, Jane Ann and Mary Ellen gave me tissues because they knew I was going to talk about this, but I don't need them. I don't. That Mormon theology has been a tremendous comfort to me in the wake of that miscarriage and that loss because of our insistence, our dogged insistence on the sanctity of human life. I feel like we're living in a culture where I'm hearing from all sides, it was only an embryo and better luck next time. And yet, I have this wonderful theological permission to feel the way I feel. I don't know what pain that you have experienced in your lives, and it's probably a lot worse than mine. In the spectrum of human history, what I've gone through is just a blip. It doesn't even come in on the radar. My life has been a picnic. I've never been in a war. I've never seen a child die of a famine or a disease. I didn't even have to cross the freaking plains. But life is still so hard, and sometimes I feel broken down by it. When I feel that way, Mormonism steps in and offers a kaleidoscopic perspective on my pain. I have always loved kaleidoscopes to witness the patterns and the gorgeous colors that can be created just by cranking a handle. I find it mesmerizing. But kaleidoscopes exhibit a beauty that is born of pain. Those patterns that we see from a distance are actually just random shards of broken glass, just bits and pieces of crushed, colored glass. If every painful and beautiful experience that I've ever had is a shard of glass, Mormonism gives me the promise that not one of those shards will be wasted. All the bits and pieces of our broken lives will be used to make something beautiful, a pattern of wholeness and grace. That's a belief that keeps me going, that enables me to contribute to the river and to the sea. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
would like to thank you for attending tonight, for being a part of this community, and once again, thank John Kessler and Jenna Reese for sharing their lives and their faith with us. Thank you.